Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competitions.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, she'd be the granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right.
So it's Arsenal at Stamford Bridge this evening. It's the first leg of the Carabao Cup. So Philippe Auclair is with us. Philippe, you followed Arsene Wenger's career very closely. You've defended him on numerous occasions. Where are we in early 2018, Arsene Wenger?
Okay, I've defended it. I've tried to be as fair as possible to the man and to the manager. We are not in a very happy place. I think you can say that without risking being contradicted by either the events past, present or future. I think Wenger is in a difficult situation at the moment. I don't think he's enjoying himself very much at all. That's certainly the impression I've had when I've had the chance to talk to him, which have been a few occasions since the beginning of the season. It's been really up and down with some great performances, like the game against Chelsea very recently, or especially the game against Tottenham in the Premier League, even the defeat against Manchester United, but also some big downers, I was going to say, in terms of results, is also in terms of performance. And an Arsenal team which at the moment, you know, of course, we're talking about a very important game tonight, which in a normal context wouldn't be important at all when you think about the way that Wenger has treated the used the League Cup or Carabao Cup, whichever way you call it, in the past, two finals and playing with the youngsters. And it's always been a good, I was going to say, an extension of the training ground for him, for his new players, his young players, and sometimes the players needing to come back from injury and so forth. This is not the case. I've done a little calculation before talking to you. I was wondering, you know, looking at where Arsenal is in the league at the moment. Okay, I was thinking, well, how many points per game is that? And if you calculate that over a season, what does that give us? And I was quite shocked, actually. I wasn't aware that it was that bad, but it is really bad. And it's 1.77 point per game, which gives you a total of 67 points at the end of the season, which wouldn't be enough to do the top six compared to last season's final table. So that's really bad. In the league, I cannot remember a moment where it's been as bad as that at this time of the season. Actually, I can't remember it because it hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So, no, he's not in a happy place, which is why the games tonight and then later in January are so important to define that season. And with which many people and more people are thinking could be Arsene's last at the Emirates.
I mean, we've had this dance before. We're coming up on the year anniversary where he was in the stands for four matches for an altercation with one of the referees. And so it's not the first time in his career he's looked...
Taylor, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It's where he's looked like he hasn't enjoyed it. Indeed, he was in the stands in Stamford Bridge the last time, and the bloke next to him, according to Wenger, said, "I sat next to a guy who said, 'Hi, how are you?' And I said, 'Good afternoon.' And he said, 'I'm actually your gardener.' Wenger said, 'I didn't even know him. I was in the middle of the crowd. It was very uncomfortable, awkward. I will try to find a different place for this game tonight.' The lack of enjoyment is the thing, though, that maybe stands out most. His demeanour is awful. He's doing very un-Wenger-like things, like throwing in a glib remark about suicide, which is just not in keeping with his intelligence and general elegance at his very best. You wonder what he's getting out of it a lot of the time at the moment.
Yes, I am. I'm also, I, knowing him a bit, more than a bit, I'm absolutely sure that he will have lost a lot of sleep about what's happened to him, about the decisions he's made. He had a chance to get out of the club last spring. There had been contact with PSG. I mean, everybody's confirmed that to me. Everybody I've talked to who should know a bit about these things told me, yes, that's correct. There was some contact. And you're thinking, well, there have been a number of moments in the last few years when Arsene could have left on a high. And certainly leaving after an FA Cup final win and a great game as well over Chelsea, over the champion-elect, that would have been a wonderful way to bow out of and leaving a club which would have been in a better position than it was when he took over, which is the one thing that Arsene is obsessed about, that he wants to leave a club and a legacy such that his successor, whoever he is, will find the club in better shape than it was when he himself arrived on the scene. Mm. At the moment, for the first time in his reign, it's no longer the case. I know it's extraordinary to say that, but it is no longer the case. When Arsene arrived at Highbury, Dennis Bergkamp had been already recruited, a man who was a transforming force in the history of Arsenal. The structure of the team was still in place with this fantastic back four or back five, a number of very, very fine players indeed who'd gone through a couple of difficult seasons, but for reasons that had very little to do with football itself. And you're looking right now and you're thinking, if Arsene Wenger were to leave that team to somebody else, knowing that Alexis Sanchez is on the way out, knowing that Mesut Ozil is very likely on the way out, would that team be better than the team that Arsene inherited? I don't think so. Would the club be in a better state financially? Certainly, new stadium and so forth. In terms of its aspirations, ambitions, both domestically and in Europe, no. And I'm absolutely sure that Wenger is more aware of this than anybody else. Mm. And that he's questioning himself, which is maybe one of the reasons why he's so spiky at the moment, why he says things that he probably regrets 5 minutes after he said them, which is very un-Wenger-like. You're quite right. This remark was totally out of order, given the context. And there have been a few. I mean, the way he went after the referees as well. I mean, it's not the first time he's done it, but the way he's done it was also, I think, completely unacceptable from a coach of that age and that experience. And I think most people would agree with me on that. So, yes, it's a very, very, very tough moment. And then here you go. You have a semi-final of a competition which didn't really matter to you when the season started, and now it matters an awful lot. Mm.
Yeah, I think you've mentioned the word legacy there. Surely his legacy will be the move to the Emirates and how he's overseen that. Because the last 10 or 15 years, you mentioned they're on the pitch, it certainly hasn't improved, and it almost felt the inevitable was always going to happen given the fact is that they've got to this stage of the season, probably just outside the top four places, and they've got themselves in. But I spoke to Joe, Philippe, before we came in, and Joe was almost like, we've done it before, haven't we? We have done it before. But yes, it does seem that, yeah, the last four seasons, the last few seasons at least, his success in the FA Cup has almost maybe kept him in the job. But this now, there does seem utmost importance on this game tonight, over the two legs against Chelsea, that this now is almost the competition that may save his job. That's the way it seems to me in many respects, given how poor they were against Forest at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be as hard as you perhaps on the record over the past. I mean, since the last league title, there was the Champions League final in 2006. There was a great team in 2007, 2008, which, you know, completely lost it after Eduardo's injury in that game in Birmingham. There were some great moments and some seasons where you thought, actually, maybe it's going to work. It never quite worked in the end. We quite know that. This season is a bit different because it's never really threatened to work, has it?
No.
Even two seasons ago, we shouldn't forget that it is Arsenal who finished second in the league. And I know it was in special circumstances. And many people, including myself, would have said they should have put a much stronger challenge, you know, to Leicester. But they finished second in the league, which was, you know, perfectly acceptable, to say the least. But this season, I mean, the last two seasons have been, it's a very steep decline. It's a bit like, if I can use a football simulation, like a goalkeeper, when he starts to lose it. You know, a player sometimes, by managing his games, spreading, you know, his energy and giving his all, I mean, you know, being able to manage his game time can prolong his career by 2, 3, 4 years. Keepers, it's not the case. When they go, they go. And I think that at the moment, Arsene is a bit in the position of a keeper who suddenly realizes he's not quite as good as he used to be. And you can't get that back.
Just on that, again, I maybe go back to this legacy thing as well with him. He's built up this legacy of finishing the Champions League over the last few years. Of course, that didn't happen last season, so they're in the Europa League this year. The 5 points off the Champions League again now, it looks to me unlikely, certainly the way that they're playing. As you mentioned there, the Ozils and the Sanchez. Sanchez could be going over the next couple of weeks. Maybe one thing I'll say, that why then? Why does he keep putting himself in this position to be criticised the way that he is?
We had quite a long interview, my French TV station, with him actually just a week ago, and he said it's a drug, and he's an addict. I think it's as simple as that. Yeah. And he's somebody for whom retirement will genuinely be a form of death before death. Mm. I don't want to sound melodramatic. I genuinely believe that's true. And I think it's been like this for a long time. It's part of his personality. He's incredibly driven. He's hypercritical of himself, but also hypersensitive to criticism. So you could say, well, it's a pretty potent kind of mix when it comes to personality. And he's now 68. He doesn't like to hear people saying, you're too old for the job. You're too old for the job. He hates it. Mm. And it's his life. It's always been his life. It's been his life ever since, you know, even when he was still playing for Strasbourg and, well, Mützig before that, he was already preparing his career as a manager and as a coach after that. It's all he knows. It's his life. Mm. So, yes, he doesn't want to. I mean, imagine being in charge of a club for so long and shaping it as he did and having the amount of power that he has, that he had and still has, even though perhaps less than in the past, which is an interesting conversation to have, by the way. But he wants to carry on. Mm. Very interestingly, he mentioned the possibility of taking care of a national team, which is something he'd never mentioned before. He always says, it's not something which is made for me, and he's mentioning it now. I think he's feeling a bit tired, to be honest.
Yeah, it does feel that way. Yeah, and even the Arsenal fans are a bit tired. Remember last year, you know, we'd get great fun over the last 2 years of playing the latest rant on Arsenal fans TV. There were protests, there was anger. Even that's a bit resigned and a bit flat. Like, it hasn't even felt like much of a crisis this year, even though it's been as bad as it's ever been.
No, and what you see is that, you know, I go to the Emirates very regularly, and I see empty seats almost at every game, including big games, and I'm thinking, well, you know, part of the reason is because the season ticket is very expensive and people tend to share those. And not everybody is, you know, is that keen on going to games. I mean, it's like the game against Köln in the Europa League. Yeah. There was hardly anybody there. Yeah. Well, the Köln fans were there, that's for sure. But it's not quite the same. And you're quite right. I don't see Wenger banners. There are no demonstrations in the streets. Well, I call them demonstrations. Probably you're giving them too much credit for calling them demonstrations. Mm. But you don't see the same amount of protest. You see people who seem to be resigned, think, okay, it's going to come to an end. And there's a lot of sadness, that, you know, and everybody, genuinely, every single Arsenal fan that I know wishes him well and wants the story to finish with a happy ending. But it's not going to be the case. We know that. The only, you know, you can imagine if Arsenal won the Europa League, for example, and qualified for the Champions League next year like that, that would be a lovely end. But that's going to be tough, isn't it? Mm.
The curiosity with Wenger, ultimately, I mean, we've had this conversation so many times, so in some respects I've lost all enthusiasm for it. But when the decline was first very evident and the trends of his mistakes were so similar, like, you know, the greatest cliche in the world now is that Arsenal aren't very good at the back. And this has been the story for, well, you know, a decade. It's like this man who's hypercritical of himself and has seen the value of a brilliant back four up front and personal. Like, it's the Wenger mystery boils down to why the same failings emerge season after season after season after season. And I've never, ever heard a great answer to that. Maybe he doesn't know the answer.
Maybe not. Things have changed in the way that the team is run, in the medical department, in the analysis department. in the recruitment department. Things have changed a lot over the last 4 or 5 years. People have been brought in, whether they're given the space to do what they can do, they're given the responsibilities they should be given, is another matter altogether. It's a bit of a, you know, when people say, oh yes, you know, he's never evolved, and what was revolutionary 20 years ago, 25 years ago, is no longer revolutionary. Yeah, that's true. But I would say that most Arsenal supporters would agree with me that the things which are lacking in the team at the moment, there's nothing revolutionary about it. There's a lack of fight, which you saw in the FA Cup tie against Nottingham Forest, which was quite shameful, really. There's a lack of defensive organization. I wouldn't necessarily agree that the personnel at the back, that, by the way, is that bad. Petr Cech had a fantastic game against Chelsea. Perhaps it's not the Cech of a few seasons ago. Ospina is a very capable deputy. Laurent Koscielny is one of the, I would say, success stories of his signings. People have forgotten about that. He can still, you know, that was not that long ago. Well, okay, that was a while ago, but not that long ago. Hector Bellerin was thought of as a possible target for Barcelona and a possible for the Spanish national team. Nacho Monreal, who is injured, is in the starting 11 of one of the favorites for to win the World Cup in 2018. And you look around, Chouanan Mustafi is not a bad central defender. I'm sorry, people will say that. That's rubbish. He's not. He's not at all. He wouldn't have been, you know, selected by Germany if he, you know, in a position where Germany have quite a few decent players. If he were a rubbish player, he's not a rubbish player. Neither Rob Holding or Callum Chambers are awful players. They might not be as, you know, quite the quality that people expect them to be, but the thing is that they have seem to have hit a ceiling very quickly, and that's been the case for so many recruits of Arsenal in the past few years. Players whom you thought were going to develop and haven't done so, have actually regressed in some ways. I mean, Theo Walcott being the most amazing example of that. I mean, this symbol of base. I think Walcott, in a way, will also be remembered as the symbol of those last 10 years.
Okay, Philippe, pleasure as always. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you very much, guys.
Take care.
Ribeiro, what type of midfielder is Ribeiro? He's not a box-to-box. He's not defensive. He can't do a f***ing killer pass. Why is he on the f***ing pitch? What for what? See him come here and f***ing bust us at Old Trafford. This is Man United talking. See him come here and f***ing bust us. Rojo, what has he? What was his tactics? As soon as you get Rojo, just f***ing do it. We're not f***ing Stoke. We're Man f***ing United here. Watch. That was diabolical, that. Martial is playing against a f***ing centre midfielder in doubt. Take the f***ing on. Take him on and f***ing do it. We're Man f***ing United here.
All right, so nil all, 52 minutes gone at Stamford Bridge. Just in while Neil was talking there before the sting, Kev, Chelsea really putting something together, just a bit of pace about their attack.
Yeah, a big chance as well for Christensen. He missed a sitter, really. He was ahead, he was probably about 3 yards out, and it was one of those, he's coming on to me, he arrived at it quite quickly and just couldn't quite get the header on target, but a big chance there for Chelsea. Chelsea, as you say, they've just injected a little bit of pace into the game now, yeah.
Much excitement about VAR. Martin Atkinson holding his hand.
You should be listening to the Sky commentary, Joel. I've been listening to it in there. Sorry, Joe. I've been listening to it in there, and honestly, there's so much excitement around this. Every time there's any incident, we've got VAR. We have VAR tonight. You know that. There's a lot of excitement.
But they're already looking ahead to Sky Sports Years. They want it's their commentary, you know, to be the one. Which
exactly.
Will be read out by Claire Tomlinson on the show. So Atkinson held his hand up to his ear. And then they thought they would have the moment where he would go over and review something on the screen. But the lads in the office miles away told him there's no need.
Yeah, there was an incident with, it was Victor Moses and Maitland-Niles. Maitland-Niles, it was very similar to the sort of incident with Eden Hazard last week and Hector Bellerin. Yeah. Where Bellerin just got caught the wrong side, kicked out, he caught Hazard. Similar sort of incident. I didn't necessarily see any contact with Maitland-Niles from Victor Moses. And I think the VAR got it right, yeah.
Okay, so we'll talk to Alan Kelly about that. Alan Kelly, you'll know, he's been working in the MLS since 2014 or so. He's reffed in Champions League group matches and UEFA Cup group matches as well, or Europa League, whichever it was when he did it. But he's going to join us because they haven't in the MLS. He uses it. He'll give us a flavour of how it all works. I think he initially said he wasn't overly in favour of it, but he thinks it works quite well. So he'll join us later on. But first, the Martin O'Neill situation rumbles on. The FAI today have said that Stoke City have made no contact with them. We're not sure if they need to. And the Telegraph, amongst a few others, certainly have said, the headline I have here in the Telegraph by John Percy, Stoke contact Martin O'Neill as search for Mark Hughes' successor gathers pace. Stoke make contact with Martin O'Neill as they ramp up their search for a new manager. O'Neill's been sounded out by the Stoke hierarchy, he says, and is expected to hold talks over a potential return to the Premier League. Dan McDonald of the Irish Independent is here in studio.
Hi guys.
The plot thickens here.
This is in the sort of pantheon of Martin O'Neill speculation stories with sort of, I don't know which would be at the bottom of the list, like any story which consists of there was a number of bets, you know, reportedly staked last night and he's now like 3-1 favourite.
One lad in Sligo put on €15.
He's that much of a certainty that the bookies are willing to leave him at 3-1 while putting out a press release on him. No. There's definitely something to this one. This is not I don't think this is a flyer. I don't think this is something that's been sort of produced for slow news day purposes. I think this is something that's a very viable scenario, basically. And I mean, why wouldn't it be in some ways when, I mean, there's been sort of countless sources and sort of people who'd be very much on top of the brief in that area, you know, speaking about how Gary Rowett and then O'Neill were two options and then one of them drops out and signs a new contract. They want someone quickly. They want someone with Premier League experience. It's known that the Stoke, Peter Coates and O'Neill get on quite well and that they hold him in high enough regard. So, I mean, it's not quite 2+2 stuff. There's reason to believe that there's genuine justification.
It won't rumble on forever because John Percy in his Telegraph report anyway says that O'Neill, who was always in Stoke's thoughts, they're now planning to meet with the Ulsterman, with the club hopeful of making an appointment before Monday's trip to Manchester United. He's not guaranteed the job at this stage, with Stoke still considering other candidates.
The one thing I'd say, I mean, I'd put it to you, Dan, that we've had a few messages put into us tonight about the contact with the FAI, and where do they come into it? Because he's out of contract. Do Stoke have any obligation to go to the FAI and inquire about his services?
My understanding of that would be no. I mean, he doesn't have a contract. Maybe there's an element of common courtesy you could argue about it. There's a verbal agreement in place rather than a contract being signed, unless they're going to produce this, but there's no suggestion that any contract has been signed at all. In fact, when the announcement was made about O'Neill staying on, they hadn't even discussed like terms and conditions at that point. It was very much, let's have it out there that you're staying. And I think the FAI were pretty keen to get that done. The players' rules would be, the last 6 months of contract or something, isn't it? You're free to speak to other parties. When someone's out of contract, I don't see why there would have to be any approach at all. So, and I think we've seen this with Martin O'Neill, even in terms of the courtship for the FAI job in the first place, that he's very much his own man who sort of does things at his own pace. The one thing you would say is, you've Stoke who wants an urgent appointment, and O'Neill tends to think and dwell on getting things done rather than maybe rashly doing something. But I guess in his own way, it's maybe been considered enough. I mean, I'm sure at any point, if he went into the FAI and said, I want this contract done, it would be done. So he's probably pragmatic enough himself to know that, his reputation doesn't seem to have been affected in the UK by the Danish result.
He's done a bloody great job with those Irish. That's the general
term. Element to that.
The Trapattoni situation was kind of the same. From the outside, it was, well, Trapattoni, what a magician, still alive from the old dog yet. Because we contacted the FAI on
yesterday.
Monday. It was Monday.
Was it Monday, was it?
Just ask them a few questions. Is the contract signed? Have you spoken to Roy Keane about his situation? Various things. And the answer to everything was, we're not commenting on the managerial situation. So today they were very quick to come out and say, we haven't had any contact from Stoke. But of course, the pertinent question I wonder is, have you had any contact from Martin O'Neill?
Yeah.
When have you spoken to him?
Mm. Yeah. And that's the real. Now, I know the FAI would say that it's sort of business as usual with O'Neill. For example, I think he's down to go to Switzerland in 2 weeks' time for the Nations League draw. I think he's, you know, booked up to go on that. I think all managers have been urged to go by UEFA, etc., for this new competition. He was involved. He was over recently enough. I think it was December time to have discussions about 2018. I would say they wouldn't have announced games in Turkey and France and so on without having an agreement with the manager. In fact, they're having a little training camp in Turkey before the game over there. So he has been part of discussions, and there is no reason, you know, for the FAI to think, I suppose, that at that point there was something in his head about leaving. But events happen, and if you have a manager that's not well, under
Mark
contract,
Hughes was in the job this
Mark
day last
was
week.
In a job, and again, you know, it seemed like Gary Rowett might have been the preferred choice, then he's not available. Mm. So things happen, as you know, have in football. It just things move on very quickly. And while the FAI maybe have very good reason to believe that everything is fine, I think in this one, it's not as if there's a manager who's got a 2-year contract and a compensation figure in his head. That's not the case in this instance.
McDonald's usually so cautious. I thought you were going to come in here and say, there's nothing in this. Yeah. I'm not willing to put my name to any speculation here. But McDonald's come in and said there's something in this now. Now it's become more serious than I thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think this one is probably evolving. Okay. You know, I think this one is developing, and I would think it now. It's not a flyer. It's not one of these mad speculation stories. I mean, the one previous one, which actually at the time might have been. I mean, he did have interest from Leicester before Ranieri, and at that point, I think there was a sense he was halfway through his first campaign, and there would have been a sense of unfinished business maybe about it. In some ways, like, this isn't a bad time to break. Yeah. He's done two campaigns. We've certainly know from people close to him that he was stung by the reaction to the Denmark result and the criticism that he received. So I'm not sure if there's a situation there where it would be the huge wrench that it might have been. It's not as if you're leaving a group of players halfway through a campaign, like sort of, was it Laurie Sanchez that time? Yeah. Or, you know, where there's something ongoing.
Yeah. That was the point I was going to make about the... how he felt as though he was maybe perceived here as well. So the criticism that he received after that Denmark game as well, that's certainly got to play into his mind, hasn't it? If he gets a big job, which is still a big job, Premier League job, Stoke coming in from the way that they are, you think he's probably the sort of manager that could go in there and get that short-term fix for them, for Stoke, but also from his own point of view. And the other thing I did wanted to make as well, I read your piece today about could he job share, do the job to the end of the season? There's no suggestion that wouldn't make any sense from the FAI's point of view or from Stoke's point of view.
No,
really.
That seemed to have been floated initially. I'm not sure if that's an option now at all. I think the FAI, John Delaney, said at one point that type of thing probably wouldn't be viable. And I just think the optics of that would be dreadful from the FAI's point of view, really. It's
job share very easily to the end of the season?
I think
he doing?
It's the only... Now, the next 6 months, like these Nations League games count for something in the autumn. If you're talking about a rebuilding job, like you're saying that this is a very important thing. The next 5-6 months are the window to get work done, tie down Declan Rice or whatever it needs to be done. You know, go and see all the players, even guys at under 23 level, whatever it might be. Greg Cunningham, Matt Doherty, there's still stuff to do.
Do you think, Joe? Do you seriously think he could do that job to the end of the season? And do you think it would play favourably on the FAI?
The optics wouldn't be good. It wouldn't play favourably. But if the FAI were determined to keep him, then they could keep him that way. If he said, look, I want to crack at this, I'll get my £2 million bonus if I keep him up. Keeps me active, keeps me in the game. I get around and see enough to players. I'll lock down Declan Rice. Don't you worry about that. Roy is going to be out. I mean, where's Roy in all this, I wonder? Roy's going to be out checking out the young talent. I'll watch some videos during the week. I've got the whole summer as well. The season's over in May, and then I come back and I really get stuck in. It keeps me fresh. I'm at the cutting edge of the game. I'm working against the best managers in the world.
I'll put 2 points out there then, right? So he does really well, and then Stoke want him to stay.
Oh, then he's gone.
So
then
he's wasted.
But this is your only chance to keep him.
But the other side is he has an absolute nightmare. He has an absolute stinker. Then all of a sudden, we are then questioning why he's going to come back into the Irish job. Mm-hmm. So it's a lose lose for the FAI. Of course it is.
What if he does about okay?
Just about keeps him up on the last day of the season.
Finished 15th. So we're happy to have him back. And well,
he comes back absolutely exhausted by the whole thing, and he's like, rebuild with this.
I appreciate a job share.
I just don't see that being a scenario that unfolds from this point, I don't think.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just going to go over to Stamford Bridge. So 63 minutes on the clock, Richard Newman.
Chelsea 0, Arsenal 0. The home side came out well in the second half, wasting several chances so far. N'Golo Kante unluckily had a goal-bound shot hit his own teammate Andreas Christensen, who minutes later headed over in the six-yard box. Alvaro Morata has also had an effort well saved by David Ospina and gone close from a tight angle too. A worry for Arsenal captain for the night, Jack Wilshere, given his past injury problems. Off after taking a knock, didn't look in serious discomfort, but straight down the tunnel. Goalless at Stamford Bridge.
Kevin McLaman, would you like Martin O'Neill to stay on?
That's a good question, Joel. Very good question.
Well,
I think, in a word, yes, okay. I would. And the reason what it is now, I just think that he has agreed the contract. I don't think it would look favourably on anyone if now that contract that had been agreed, he was to go. I think he must have had it in his head in agreeing that contract, where he's going to go in the next year, in getting the side prepared for the next round of qualification, or the next round of meaningful games. So yes, I would like to see him stay. Yeah,
actually, as you said that initially, you described him going as lose-lose. It's actually lose-lose-lose-lose, because the third part of those four loses, if you're still with me, I appreciate it. If you're not, it's no problem. Mm. But the third part is O'Neill looks slightly underhand. You know, like, you kind of made a commitment and you've slightly, you self-righteously said a few times in press conferences, look, I gave my word. So how dare you ask me with this kind of a tone? So that would kind of leave a slightly bad taste, but fair enough. I appreciate he's only got one career. And then the fourth lose of my four loses is the FAI. Why did you not get him to sign the contract?
Well, I mean, this is the point.
That blows up big time.
And I think this is an important part of this discussion, that we can sort of sit around the table here and say, well, would you like him to stay? Would you not like him to stay? You know, and there is, I know that the public, you know, you speak to fans, there's really mixed views out there on the question you would ask Kev there. A lot of people are of the no persuasion. But what's clear is that the FAI very much wanted him to stay. And in October, before the game in Wales, they wanted him to stay enough that they were very keen to get him to agree to stay at that point. So it would be very hard for the FAI, if he does go, to subsequently come out and put some kind of spin on it and say that they were in control of this situation. If you've decided before the Wales game that this is your guy for 2020, you have no doubts about the direction of this regime, etc., etc. And then you've allowed this loose arrangement to continue, and that leaves you open to losing him. I think it's very hard to explain that one. As I mean, do you come out afterwards and say, well, actually, after Denmark, we sort of knew, you know, maybe it wouldn't be the worst things if things parted? I don't think it's palatable to actually say that. And I mean, we must remember, he did start the World Cup campaign in Serbia without the contract signed. Like, the contract wasn't signed for this campaign until 3 weeks into it. So I guess the FAI could argue that they've always had this loose sort of gentleman's arrangement. And that's always been how it's been explained, that there's a good element of trust and understanding between the parties. But
Until it blows up, it still leaves you open.
And maybe the right job never come up at the right time during that impasse before, whereas it might well be that this was the right job.
You've got to get a prenup, Dan.
Well, you should know. What are you thinking about sitting there?
You know? I'll tell you what, imagine that. You set yourself up sometimes, Joel. Honest to God.
That was sorry,
straight home tonight to discuss
outrageous.
This.
I think as well, off the back of that as well, though, is it's what... I don't think the FAI could probably deal with that any other way. They have to have put the trust in him.
Yeah.
But they can say, look, well, I tell you what, we have got a long time before the next. We don't necessarily need to jump in and get a new coach or a new manager tomorrow. We can actually take our time on it. Martin O'Neill can actually turn around and say, well, I tell you what, the way it went after the Denmark game, it did sit uneasy with me. So that can be the out from both parties, can't it? That's the thing.
I think that would almost certainly be the out. I think it can be explained, but it's one thing to listen to the out. It's another to sort of be conscious of how keen the FAI were to keep him and believe that they wanted this scenario to materialise, if it does materialise. I think it's more of a runner now than other ones, you know? No,
that wouldn't be the truth. The truth is Stoke came along and that's what would
that's
do
what's
it.
Changed things.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, I mean, we're probably wildly speculating here at this point, but I suppose the other thing which would make you think there's a bit of something in this is Martin O'Neill's not necessarily reading the Irish Independent every day or worried about the off-the-ball show.
No.
Even my ego will allow me to admit that.
What the football men are saying.
Yeah, but it's in the Telegraph today. It's been on Match of the Day. Martin O'Neill, one of the favourites for the job. It's been much talked about. It's been a UK story. He certainly pays attention to the UK press. If he had no intention of going anywhere, because it's not the first job he's been linked with, the West Ham job and the Everton job, it might have crossed his mind, you suspect, over the last number of days to say, God, this won't play very well in Ireland. I'm just going to come out and say, by the way, I'm committed to Ireland. There's no point linking me with these jobs. I'm going nowhere. And we've tumbleweeded into he's having talks.
I've never got the sense that speculation about other jobs has really bothered him that much. Okay. I think it's to be talked about is a good thing. It's when they're not talking about you, that's the problem.
Fair enough.
And I think there's always been a sense, and I think he is aware, and that stuff that came out in the Telegraph in the aftermath of the Denmark game, that he was, you know, stung by the criticism, and there was a sense at that point that maybe he wouldn't be that perturbed by leaving the job, rather than he might have been at other points. Yeah, I don't think that sort of stuff bothers him. I think it's good to be mentioned in the game because, I mean, when he came to the job initially, it appeared that like he needed a bit of convincing to go down that road, that he still felt he had that bit of unfinished business in club management. And it may well be that still lingers.
And one last point. I don't suppose there's any concrete answers here. Where's Roy Keane in all of this?
Yeah, that's another very valid talking point. I mean, as I said, this is a sort of an evolving one. I'd say tomorrow's sort of newspapers, maybe our own newspaper might be bringing it on. I'm such a company
get
man.
Out.
I'm such a company. I'm a shameless company man.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable stuff. No, it is.
No, I mean, you're unbelievable. You come in here and drop that one. So what's happened with Roy?
No,
it's, just say we're past the embargo.
No, there's no embargo. It's genuinely something I think that's ongoing tonight, trying to ascertain actually what's happening.
Okay.
But what I would say is that this relationship, they come in as two individuals, O'Neill and Roy, as two different groups. But there has been times when we've asked Roy about his intentions, about his own future, and he's spoken about sort of working with Martin. So, I mean, it's entirely possible he's going to be part of this equation going forward. O'Neill, yeah. I mean, then the Ireland job is obviously the other thing.
Yeah.
But O'Neill is, you know, he is very much the man in the centre of the whole thing. You know, there's no doubt about that. But, I mean, it may well be that Roy is part of the O'Neill ticket now, rather than he's never worked for the FAI as such, Roy Keane. He's always been working for Martin O'Neill as part of his backroom team.
That said, if O'Neill goes to Stoke and says, come on with me, Roy, and the FAI say, Roy, do you want to have a little chat here in the side room? Then that's another.
But that is
issue.
That is another angle to the whole thing, and this is. I mean, there's a serious unanswered questions to the whole thing here, you know, and this is the stuff that if this comes to fruition, and it's still a huge if at this point, that these are the questions that are going to have to be teased out in the coming days. But I would assume, you know, the backroom staff have been pretty tight. They were meant to be in Dublin this week for like a soccer writers' dinner. They come to it every year. O'Neill, Roy, all the backroom staff, they really enjoy it.
I'm missing that as well this week. So yeah,
he's missing it. Yeah. I mean, but the other bombshell, bigger even than Kev missing it, is the fact, Jared, that they don't appear to be attending. Now people are saying it's nothing to do with anything that's going on at the moment, nothing to do with being upset over criticism, blah blah blah, but you know, it's unusual, you know, it's first weekend in January or second weekend in January. They've enjoyed it in previous years. What's changed here? So
okay,
can tease that one out.
Tom McDonald from the Irish Independent, we know where your loyalties lie. We'll see what's in the papers tomorrow, and thanks for coming in. Appreciate it, Tom.
Arsene Wenger's been in Japan for a year. They don't know anything about English football.
I'm not one to envy people because I've always had reasonable things going for me. The people who envy things, they envy the things they can't get.
Is that the use of a big club, Arsenal? Maybe next year he could be in the same situation, and I wonder what his story will be then.
You know, he's a specialist in failing. I'm not.
You can tell him now, if you're watching it, we're still fighting for this title, and he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Look, we had no petrol, but ideas. We have petrol and ideas, so that makes it even more efficient, you know.
Our opponents, they have always issues, you know, and they have big issues, and in the end, everybody's ready to play, so they have phenomenal organizations. We are a bit more humble. When we have a problem, we have a problem. I tell you the truth.
Saying there during the ad break, so you reckon O'Neill and Keane are a package? You think if Martin went, Keane went? The Telegraph is saying they'll have talks. Your guess is
it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case. Yeah,
which I said to you paves the way. Big Mick, come on back. You've unfinished business. Kevin Kilbane is number two, and you still work on the show.
No, I'd
still
walk.
Do 3 days a week here.
I'd walk.
Mick, and you be Mick's number two.
No, shush.
Get that going.
No.
I think that honestly.
But what I would say honestly, as well in relation,
if you gave me 15-1 at that, I'd have a nibble.
Would you?
Yeah.
Would you? No, I think with Roy as well.
In fact, I'm going to say now, you told me that's happening during the break just to get the ball rolling. I feel if I start saying it, it'll happen.
Can you imagine the FEI if they were to lose Martin and Roy? I think that would be a big one for them. It'd be a big loss losing the two of them.
Well, this business of, you know, he told me he would sign the contract looks very naive. It doesn't look like best practice then, you know?
Yeah, of course.
They might need to get him to sign the contract in light of all this, you know, like it makes it easier for clubs like Stoke to approach O'Neill. And
well, if he weren't to sign with Stoke, then I'm sure that'd be the case anyway, because it has been agreed. But I'm just saying, like, for the FEI to lose both those big names like that as well, you would imagine if Martin O'Neill was to leave, then Roy Keane would be in pole position to take the job, wouldn't he?
Mm.
That's the thing.
Mm.
How could he turn the job down if he were to be offered it?
It's true. Yeah, so interesting times. This is all kind of blown up out of nothing. Like, it just seemed like idle bookies talk on Monday, and then Gary Rowett got the job, and now English papers reporting that there's going to be talks with O'Neill.
Yeah. There is talks.
If you're having talks, that's very serious. Talks generally end well.
Yeah.
And
I think you pointed out the fact is that they want someone in place for Monday. So that's...
This could break quickly.
Yeah.
Or not at all, who knows. So it's still nil-all between Chelsea and Arsenal, 77 minutes on the clock. Still no VAR.
No.
As far as we can tell. Which brings us to our next guest. Referee Alan Kelly is back on the show, a referee in the MLS since 2014. He's reffed in UEFA Cup at the time and Champions League group stages games. Alan, thanks a million for coming on again.
No problem. Good evening, Joe. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Alan.
So VAR... All the commentators over the last 48 hours are desperate for it to happen on their watch. They want to be the commentators on Sky Sports years, Premier League years and decades to come as the moment. I presume it's not very dramatic when it happens. A referee, well, you do it. So you jog across the side of the pitch and have a look at a screen?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I haven't seen tonight's game, but I looked at Monday's game between Brighton and Palace with interest. I think everybody or a lot of people tuned in specifically for VAR, and there wasn't anything related to VAR in it. And tonight seems to be the same. I've been following it on Twitter, the updates, but nothing of any significance or consequence to require VAR. So yeah, when that happens, if the video assistant referee requires the referee to take a look at or review something that he or she deems to be a clear and obvious error, then that will happen. The game will stop. The referee will make his way over to the video screen at the side of the field or behind the goal, wherever it may be stationed. We'll take a look at what the VAR will send down, that being the best possible angle, best viewing angle, mm-hmm. to enable the referee to determine whether a clear and obvious error has been made.
Yeah. Tonight we saw Martin Atkinson. The most dramatic moment was him telling the player to shush because he was listening to somebody in his ear. So the VAR is in the same operations room the whole time, regardless of where the match is, in Uxbridge?
Yeah, just near Heathrow Airport.
Okay. So presumably at that stage, Atkinson had either asked for clarification on something or the VAR had come in of his or her own volition to just clarify something with Atkinson. What's likely to be going on there in those conversations in your experience?
Yeah, well, the main thing is that the referee will referee the game as they normally referee it. They won't referee it any differently because of VAR. And that's in our training, in our education, in the build up to this, that's always been the case. You referee normally. And in the event something's missed, that's it. The referee might be asking for some sort of clarification, or he might be explaining what he has seen in an incident just to give the VAR clarification. But that's it. You know, if it's if there is a review to be made, referee will make a clear box stroke TV type signal. Will go to the screen and we'll take a look at what the VAR sends down, and that being the best possible angle to determine that a clear and obvious error is made. And I keep kind of saying the same thing over clear and obvious error, and it does have to be a clear and obvious error. The if you remember Brighton's second goal,
just going to ask you that, yeah.
Yeah, Brighton's winning goal on Monday night was Glenn Murray. And when it happened, I'm thinking, oh, this, you know, was there a handball there? Was there not a handball there? It might be something that the VAR will take a look at specifically, but not review down to the referee, because, you know, the VAR is always looking and checking behind the scenes as to what's going on. So I'm quite certain that the VAR will have looked at that at every angle available to, I think it was him on the night, and would have obviously determined that, even if there was the very slightest of touches, and I'm not suggesting that there was, but even if there was the very slightest of touches, it's got to be clear and obvious to the VAR to say, yeah, that's definitely a handball there.
Okay.
And if there's any sort of doubt, there's like they looked at, I was looking at it here, and they looked at it on four or five different angles, and you couldn't determine whether it touched the hand on any of those angles. And if that's the case, then the decision on the field stands.
Okay, so they clearly want to avoid getting into just a very messy area where slightly subjective decisions are almost being debated between a VAR and a referee. So it's clear and obvious, and there's almost a strict policy in place over that. So have you found it good? It must be kind of nice to be refereeing a game and not dreading going in at halftime or full time to find out that you've missed something absolutely monumentally obvious. That must give you a certain amount of confidence. Do you find it good?
Yeah, I've had I think maybe 15 MLS games with VAR now, and like we had spent a lot of time in the build up to it, going through every possible scenario. There was a phenomenal amount of behind the scenes work done. So it came into effect on August 5th. First game went fine. The second game I had a review to make. And as a referee, you know, you don't want to have to make a review or have something to look at. But when you do, you know, the process for me was, in my head, I'm thinking, oh, no, I've missed something here, you know. But at the same time, I missed something that was clear and obvious when you went back and looked at it, but not clear and obvious in play, if you know what I mean. And ultimately, the right decision was made. And that's what VAR is for. It is to determine the clear and obvious errors, not the situations that are subjective, because, look, that's what football is all about. And if we get into that side of it, then it'll ruin the flow of the game, which is absolutely what VAR is not for.
Alan, I just wanted to talk to you, or ask you, sorry, about there was a game last week in Serie A, Juventus against Torino. There looked a clear foul in the build-up to the second goal, the Mandzukic goal in the game, and Mihailovic, the Torino manager, clearly had seen the foul. He wanted the review. The review went in, and the referee went and reviewed it, didn't see the foul, didn't give it and give the goal. So have you come across that sort of instance then, where the referee has overruled the VAR and then the mayhem has started? You see, he sent Mihailovic to the stand, and there's certainly a lot of sort of grey area within it.
Yeah, on the Serie A one, I haven't seen that. But in terms of your other question, in terms of have I seen the referee overrule the VAR? Yes, I have, and we've had a minimal amount of those during the season last year, where the referee made the decision on the field of play, the VAR determined that a clear and obvious error was made. The VAR sent it for review to the referee, and the referee was happy that the decision that he made on the field of play was correct. Now, that was a red card scenario as opposed to a foul, no foul. A referee, like, this is exactly what we don't want. You know, like, we don't want one referee saying, well, you know, I think it's a foul, but somebody else might not think it's a foul. Basically, rule of thumb is, if there's 10 referees in the room, you show an incident, all 10 will say, yeah, that's a foul, as opposed to 5 saying, well, yeah, that's a foul, and 5 saying, maybe it is, maybe it's not. You want to stay away from that level of subjectivity. Yeah. You know, again, I'll go back to clear and obvious error.
It's basic stuff, really.
Yeah, and that's it. And look, from a refereeing point of view, you don't want to be wrong. You've got to be open You've got to be open to the fact that a decision you've made on the field of play, a key match incident, or whatever the case may be, is there is a clear and obvious error in the process to either a goal, a sending off, a penalty kick, or a case of mistaken identity.
Yeah, and so I'm curious, Alan, in practice, maybe not just in your own situation, but if it happens in your own situation, it'd be kind of interesting. Like, would the VAR be in your ear a little bit more than he or she might need to be? Like, for instance, I'm thinking, say you give a fairly innocuous free in the centre circle and there's no need to go to VAR. Say it's not a free, there was no contact, but look to you like there was, and the free's given and the players turn around and go, ugh, and then play resumes. Might the VAR in your ear go, by the way, you got that wrong, just in case you're wondering?
No.
Okay.
No, the whole philosophy of VAR is minimum interference for maximum benefit.
Okay, and would you like someone to be in your ear and say, do you know what, that free you gave there in the halfway line, actually, it wasn't a free. Just so you know, just if you're wondering, would you like to be talked through a game? Would that be helpful? Or
no, not really. No, like when it comes to the innocuous stuff. No, you know, you definitely don't want that extra voice literally in your ear, you know. You don't want that. No, if it comes to a key match incident, let's say there's a shout for a penalty kick, and you don't see it as a penalty kick, play continues, you know, the VAR will be reviewing it behind the scenes, and when play next goes dead, if the VAR comes on and says, hey, I've reviewed that, no penalty, that just gives you that little bit of encouragement, that little bit of a boost.
Okay. Yeah, you're not worrying about it. Mm. Yeah. And how long might go if the VAR comes in and says, that was a penalty? So is it 10 seconds, 30 seconds? Like, could 3 minutes of play go by and the game's brought back? How does all that work?
That's a really good question, and a situation that you absolutely want to avoid as a referee. There is no time limit on it as such. Got to make sure that the build up to the incident, that the attacking phase of play is accurate, that there's no deviation in that. If once a decision, once the incident happens, as I said, the process will be that the VAR will go into review mode straight away, will take a look, play will continue. What you're absolutely hoping is that a situation where a guy goes on in the penalty box on one end, there was nothing given by the referee. Mm. Play continues, it goes up the other end, yeah, and it ends as a goal.
Oh.
You know, that's the situation you absolutely want to avoid. So that's where the pressure, I say pressure, but that's where the VAR really comes into play, in that he or she has to review as quickly as possible. But at the same time, you know, it's not all about speed. Accuracy of the decision making is paramount here. It's not all about the speed of it.
I'm sure Jose Mourinho would be very understanding, yeah, if his team scoring the counter attack and he cancelled that out. I'm sure he'll say it's fair enough.
Alan, you know, one thing I want to ask you as well. Joe mentioned at the start, it's almost like a race between Sky and BT to see who can get the first VAR referral, I suppose. In relation to the referees themselves, do they feel a little bit more pressure, or have you felt a little bit more pressure yourself in relation to the VAR being used? Because there is extra scrutiny on you now. So do you feel that extra scrutiny, or was there a little bit of a race between the referees?
Can I jump in? Because what's happening now is very interesting. That looks like Welbeck, is it? It looks a penalty to me. Welbeck has put his foot on Fabregas. The referee gave a corner. Atkinson, the corner has now been stopped, taken. The linesman is standing in front of the ball at the corner. Atkinson is listening to someone on his referee. They've shown two replays.
This is the one. I think Sky have it
on TV. They've shown two replays on TV, and they both look like penalties to me. Now Atkinson is not moving over to the sideline to have a look, but it's almost, I mean, it really looked to me like Welbeck did not get the ball, and he gave the corner thinking he did, and Fabregas went over. So I don't know. Oh, Atkinson has waved play on. He's given a thumbs up.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, there you go.
I think he should have been brought over to have a look at that.
Yeah, I agree with that as well, actually. It looked a little bit of a grey area, I suppose, with that one. Definitely, yeah, there should have been, yeah.
Alan Kelly, have I described that okay? Do you get what's happened there?
Yeah, I can. Unfortunately for me, I can't see it, but you've described it fine. The only thing I'll say is what you've said was, it looks to me like it's a penalty. You've had a look at it once or twice.
You know, I've had a look a third time. It's a penalty. If I'm the VAR, I'm saying that is a... Oh, did he twist the ball?
He wins the ball.
Oh, he got the ball.
He wins the ball, Joe.
He got the ball on that angle. The first two angles didn't look good.
Wow, live on radio, wow. we've had a VAR scenario that you don't want.
It's a penalty!
Yeah, so you said in one breath it's a penalty, and within half a second Kevin has said no, it's not a penalty, he's touched the ball.
Sorry, you did say initially it was a penalty, Kev.
It looked it from the first angle, yeah.
First two it looked a pen, yeah. And the third cleared it up. So the VAR got the third angle.
I only came in late. I waited for the third angle. I wanted to review all my options before all the angles before I went in.
So I'm not a textbook VAR, I appreciate that.
So what would have happened there, just to give you the process there, right? The VAR will have looked at it. He might have looked at one angle that looks like a penalty.
Yeah.
You know, he might have looked at another angle that may suggest that no contact was made with the ball and it was just the player.
Yeah.
And then a third angle might have made it absolutely clear that the ball was touched before the player.
Yeah.
So that's why it's imperative that, you know, the speed of decision making is not paramount. It's the accuracy of the decision making. For the credibility of VAR, the whole VAR process is what's required on this.
Well, that was, I mean, to be honest, that was great for the game, what happened just there. It was Atkinson, Tottenham, there is a doubt about this. Antonio Conte was on the sideline drawing a square as if to say, look at the television screen.
And, yeah, can refs influence, sorry, can managers but, and coaches influence
just to finish that? Just to finish that point, I'm sure they can, they'll get involved, but... you know, the right decision was reached, and everybody knows it was the right decision now. Like, it's really good for the game. Sorry.
Most definitely. No, I'm just saying, Antonio Conte was in the touchline in the technical area, Alan, as well, and he was signalling the square. So he was signalling that, go to the VAR. Can the players do that? Can the coaches, can the managers do that?
No, it's deemed to be a cautionable offence. Right. If a player comes to a referee, and that's one of the things, you know, I'll speak specifically about MLS, that's one of the protocols where the players were educated pre-VAR last year was, you know, do not come and do not give that TV signal, that box signal to the referee, because it's deemed to be a cautionable offence. Nice. You know, everybody is made aware of the fact like that every single decision is being checked by the VAR, not necessarily for review, but every single decision, the likes of what you've just seen there, will be reviewed behind the scenes. So nobody needs to tell the referee to look at the screen. Nobody needs to tell anybody to look at that. It's already been checked. And if it's not deemed to be a clear and obvious error, it won't be sent for review.
Hmm. What about that point? Sorry, Alan, I meant before about the spotlight on the referees then. Have they embraced it? How have they felt with that extra scrutiny that's probably been on them now?
Yeah, I think, the first couple of weeks of its introduction here last year, you know, even though we had gone through a lot of training, a lot of match type scenarios in underage games and so on in the build up to a professional league launch. You know, like I suppose the first week or two, we felt that little bit of pressure because of the amount of scrutiny that's there. No more pressure than the amount of TV cameras that are there all the time. It's just that added that added facet of VAR, like VAR is the single biggest change to the game, you know, in the history of the game. I suppose once we got like a couple of weeks into it, then it just, you know, we just focused on our own game again, as opposed to VAR. And that's just human nature being that it is. So in terms of added pressure, personally, I don't feel any more pressure than we did before the introduction of VAR. And if anything, it might give us that extra couple of percent push to make sure that we're even more vigilant so that we don't have to go to a review type scenario, you know? Speaking from a personal point of view, no more added pressure, it's there to assist the game, it's there to assist us, and you know, hopefully we don't make those you know, game-changing errors when it comes to the goals, sending it off, penalty kicks, case of mistaken identity. If it is, if we do, then that's what VAR is for. VAR is there to clear up those key incidents. And again, I'll reiterate, clear and obvious error, as opposed to it may or may not have been. I think it might have been. I think it might not have been.
Yeah.
You can't let that, you know, deal with it. So when you're looking at a screen, and if you see a clearly in the first view that it's not, and clearly in the second view that it's not, it's generally not. You know, if you have to look at it four or five times, then the likelihood is that it's not clear and obvious at that point.
Mm. All very interesting. Thanks so much for coming on and explaining what it's like to work with practically. We kind of got sidetracked and went too long with you just on this issue. We were hoping to chat to you about how life is going in the MLS. We might do that another time. I trust, in short, it's going okay and you're enjoying it still.
Oh, absolutely. But enjoyment is a word that I'm not using at the moment because we're in preseason. And as Kevin knows, you know, the older you get, preseason becomes more and more of a chore.
Okay.
We're in preseason, so it's as enjoyable as preseason can get.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll let you get that out of the way, and then we might try and catch up with you for a chat about how it's all going during the season, Alan.
No worries, anytime.
Thanks, Alan.
Alan Kelly there, a referee in the MLS who is working with VAR already. Chelsea 0, Arsenal 0. They're into the fifth minute of added time.
Off the ball on News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
Welcome back. It's finished 0 all. Not bad for Arsenal, who we said tonight... Well, they couldn't screw this up too badly for the rest of the season.
Very good result for them, yeah.
Just looking at Alexis Sanchez coming off, you think, why has he not faked an injury tonight?
Well, he's probably staying at Arsenal, Joe, to end the season, isn't he?
I mean, the reason it's gone through is Jesus is injured for 2 months. What if Sanchez didn't did himself out for 2 months now?
Yeah.
He wouldn't get the move. Every other player would say, come on, it's the Carabao Cup. Yeah. He gave an applause to the Arsenal fans there. I wouldn't say it was over the top, but it was an applause.
Yeah. It was.
Will he be there for the second leg?
Well, exactly. That's the thing. It looks from what we're reading, it looks as this deal is imminent. It will happen over the next few days or whatever.
You'd have said, Gaffer. That's what you football men call your managers. You said, come on, leave me out of this.
No, I don't think I would have done. Joe would have played.
Huge move, a life changing move like that.
Well, I had a life changing move when I was at, I tell you when it was, I went from West Bromwich Albion to Sunderland were Premier League club, and Brian Little was manager at West Brom, and I actually knew that the clubs had agreed a fee. And that was it. Clubs had agreed a fee, and I went to see him, had a chat, and he said, I didn't even know this. Didn't even know. Just for another day, Joe. We'll talk about another day.
Okay. Busy day tomorrow on Off the Ball. OTBAM, we have 8-time All-Ireland winner with Cork, Aoife Murray, on the show with Owen and Jer. That's ahead of the start of the Camogie League season. OTBAM live, 7:45, Facebook, Twitter, and Off the Ball. And so if Aoife Murray has her 8 All-Irelands, Pearl Mick Fenley only has the 6, but he'll be on with Nathan in the evening. There'll be Thursday night with John Giles and Graham Hunter as well. So all of that is on the way across Off the Ball tomorrow. Good luck.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competitions.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had bought, he'd be the granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's all right.